Hello, this is the HSJ Health Check Podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and I'm joined by Zoe Tibman and Lawrence Dunhill. On this podcast, we've often talked about elective recovery targets, A&E trolley weights, and other performance measures, but something we've given less airtime to are the environmental targets the NHS has also been tasked with meeting. So this week, we're going to be talking about these targets in more detail, discussing what the NHS is doing to be more environmentally friendly and sustainable and the barriers in its way. And also on this episode, a quick update on how the NHS is preparing for winter this year. But first, Zoe, you cover sustainability as well as estates for HSJ. And I think this conversation is timed particularly well as COP28 has been ongoing. And also this week, you've launched HSJ's first ever sustainability expert briefing. So perhaps a good place to start is, could you remind us what some of the key environmental targets are that the NHS has been tasked with meeting?
Yeah, so in 2020, the NHS launched its pledge to become net zero and was the first health service in the world to do that, which was a pretty big thing. And they said they want to be net zero for their, what they call their direct emissions. So that's stuff they can directly control. By 2040, and then all the rest of them, so ones they can like influence, so stuff like suppliers, etc., by 2045. But there's some kind of interim targets in the middle, like reduce emissions by 80% by a bit earlier for some of them. But the main ones are the 2040 and then 2045 completely net zero.
So when you said some of the things that they can control, what sort of thing are we talking about?
Yeah, so stuff like their water and their waste, stuff that's like directly, you know, stuff that hospitals and trusts have direct control over. But then other stuff is kind of like patient travel, stuff they can influence by, I don't know, say better infrastructure on their site, and they can try and influence other behaviours. But I guess the direct ones are stuff where they'd, you know, have the contracts in place, like their electricity, that they can like change themselves as such.
And are there things that NHS England is trying to do, I suppose, kind of more nationally decided things to make the NHS as a whole more sustainable, I suppose, kind of less trust specific actions?
It's interesting. So talking to people in sustainability about this, I was really surprised, but people seem to want a bit more centralised action and rules and mandates to get the ball rolling with this. Because at the moment, it seems to be a lot of trusts doing their own initiatives and trying to find, I mean, it's great. And there's a lot of like innovation going on, but a lot of it is kind of at a local level. So I've been to a lot of conferences where people are presenting things, and you know, there's a lot of interest, but it is very like scattered and individual. But the NHS did, I think, start of this year, they said they were going to completely get rid of an anaesthetic gas. It's called desflurane, and it has a massive carbon warming potential. So that's like one thing. They did a complete blanket, we are going to get rid of this no matter where you are. Yeah, and there's been a few strategies and targets for individual areas come out. So there was something called the Net Zero Building Standard come out recently, which is how they envisage, you know, new building projects and doing it in a more environmentally friendly way. And that's going to be loads more rules and requirements for everyone. But I think we're kind of at the early stage of those things starting to be rolled out.
Do you think, Zoe, that sustainability leads within the local trust kind of struggle to get attention from the executive team, basically? And so that's why they often want more national direction, so they can say, look, we have to meet these targets. So we need to implement this scheme. Whereas at the moment, the exec team, that they don't really see this as an urgent work stream.
I think not just the exec team, but I think getting kind of everyone on board, because I think there is a lot of appetite, but it, Yeah, I think the exec team, but I think the whole workforce kind of, if something happens, then everyone just knows they've got to do it and there's no debate. But as you say, I feel like without those national mandates, there's a lot more, oh, you know, maybe people it will affect within the hospital, say like anaesthetists might push. I think there is a lot of support for this rule, but they might like, I don't know, push back, whereas it's, you know, you've just got to do this. But I think, yeah, in general, there is a lot of, it's quite a common thread that I hear spoken about, you know, how do we demand attention when there's so many other things going on? A lot of sustainability webinars and conferences, it's always the question, like, how do we get this to the forefront of like the exec team's minds? And people kind of share their tips and tricks and stuff, but it is definitely, yeah, a very pertinent issue.
Do they have any sort of incremental targets along the route to 2040? So they're, because they, yeah, you would have thought they'd need sort of annual, you know, bring it down by 5% per year or something.
Yeah, I found this out recently and I was quite surprised at this. I asked via Freedom of Information for like their annual targets, and they said that they don't have like annual targets for emissions every year. Rather, they, in this big net zero document, there's kind of a graph showing a possible trajectory and how they think it's possible to like reduce them emissions every year, but it's not hard and fast targets, which can make it quite difficult to judge how it's going and whether it's going to plan. We know emissions are going down, but whether they're going down by the rate that's needed, it's not clear as such.
And Zoe, as I said in the intro, you launched your column this week, mm-hmm. where every month you're kind of going to be focusing on issues, kind of sustainability issues in the NHS. And it was interesting to read about getting rid of diesel. And it's kind of, when I read it, it was like really kind of obvious to me, but I hadn't thought of it before, that actually probably ambulances are all diesel vehicles, which is of course kind of incredibly polluting. And yeah, I'd be interested to hear kind of how, what's the NHS doing about it?
It's something that's been on my radar for a while, because I know the first electric, I think it was COP26, it was launched, or 27, the first electric ambulance kind of model was launched and then got rolled out in the West Midlands. But as the column says, it's all been quite quiet since then. I think that was quite a few years back. So it's kind of been on my radar, like, what's going on with it? Why, I don't know, why aren't we getting more?
And it was just one in the West Midlands, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I, by the sounds of it, so things are starting to pick up a bit more. So NHS England released a new target specifically for travel. I think it was last month. And they said they want all new ambulances to be zero emission 2030 and the whole ambulance fleet by 2040. So when the national target is. So I've been looking into kind of what's being done now to reach that target. And it seems like NHS England say there are going to be 15 new electric ambulances starting to be delivered over the next 12 months. So it's going to be interesting to see what crews think of them, what trusts think of them, and how they work. Because, yeah, I spoke to people for the piece and listened to people talk, and there are definitely challenges. I think making sure, it's obviously not going to be as easy as, we're running out of fuel, let's like quickly stop off and refuel for 5 minutes. It's actually going to be, you know, we need to factor this into our day and sit and charge for, I think the quickest charge time someone mentioned was 45 minutes, which is obviously still quite a big chunk.
That's a long A&E handover delay right there.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it's definitely one to watch.
Yeah, it's like one of those things where it's, how does it actually work in practice? Because I don't know very many people with electric cars, but anyone I do know who has one kind of complains about sometimes it's difficult to find places to charge them, that there aren't that many chargers, that the batteries don't last that long. So it's kind of when you're rushing to an emergency and you're on, you know, a really it's literally life or death whether this vehicle is going to run. It seems like a really difficult thing to plan for.
I know. Or when you hear people like complain about that with electric cars, you're just like, gosh, imagine in an emergency setting, you've really got to plan this. And I think the way, so I heard the NHS Net Zero Ambulance lead talk about this, and he said they'd modelled it and they think they'll be able to do, with the current vehicles, 12 hours. So a 12-hour shift and then a 45-minute charge. And he seemed to think that would seem to work by like splitting it up. But yeah, obviously it's going to be a completely different way of working and something people will have to get used to.
Do they use, are there currently quite a lot of rapid response vehicles? So just not, you know, normal cars with one crew member in? Are there quite a lot of electric cars being used?
I think it's being rolled out quicker, but it's still early stages. I think they're trialing about 20 at the moment. So it's ahead of the big, you know, traditional ambulance vans. But it's still, I wouldn't say it's like commonplace yet.
And you also said that there were things that were kind of outside of the NHS's control. So companies that the NHS might, I don't know, go into business with, contract with, that seems trickier to work on.
Yeah.
I wonder, are there any examples already of that being a requirement as part of a tender, someone's kind of environmental credentials, or do you expect that to be part of things in the future? So if you want to do business with the NHS, you need to fulfill these certain criteria.
Yeah, what I'd say is, so it is probably one of the trickiest, if not the trickiest area to tackle, but it is also the biggest chunk of the NHS emissions by far. Absolutely. I think it's about 60%. Might have to check that, but I think definitely over half of the NHS emissions is their suppliers. So it's obviously a massive thing to try and get to grips with. And they are. So they've released a NHS England or supply chain have released a roadmap running over years of like what they want to do at each stage. And it is kind of incremental requirements that suppliers will have to fulfill. So there's something called a CRP. I can't remember what it stands for, but like larger suppliers do have to now like show they are like hitting certain requirements to be considered. And there's another one coming in from 2024 where it kind of picks up a bit. So it is like incrementally, getting more and more.
That's interesting. I think as well, I noticed a story, I think it was from you last week, Zoe, about banning domestic flights.
Mm.
It seems that there are those things that they can do, which might make a big difference that just haven't been done because no one's thought of it, or the attention hasn't been on it. I wonder kind of, are there kind of other things like that that you think should be done that aren't
being done? I think a lot of what's being done at the moment, and people do seem to say this, is it's kind of the easy win. So the supplier roadmap is very big and very difficult, and that is rightly being tackled. But I think stuff being done on the ground is, a lot of it is kind of what trusts can do with limited capital they have. So stuff like switching their anaesthetic gas out, or I don't know, encouraging people to cycle to work, and you know, stuff that can be done quite without massive investment. And I think the other massive challenge is trying to, and this is with my estates hat on as well, is trying to upgrade the estates, and which requires a lot of money, and trusts are either having to like bid for a incredibly competitive government pot of funding for this, which a lot of them like don't get onto, or having to dig into their limited capital budgets. So I think I think that is going to be an increase in focus, and probably one that will need increase in investment if you're going to need to upgrade these estates to be energy efficient, be run on like fossil fuel free sources. That's also quite a tricky task that is going to need a lot of looking into.
That that story about the flights is a good example, actually, that just shows, it kind of illustrates the tension between the net zero goal and the sort of forever goal of saving money and doing things efficiently. And I think, am I remember rightly, in that the number of flights were going up in the last set of data you had from NHS England staff. And their defence is, well, if it's cheaper to fly and it saves management time, then it's difficult not to do that. But they've also said they are going to ban it from 2025. So whether you know, you'll keep getting that data and the trend that now shows will tell them which side has won, I suppose. My suspicion is that they're not going to be banned, and it will keep happening.
I can envisage a world where there ends up being a lot of kind of exemptions, or this ends up being much, or this was like a last minute trip and the train was too expensive. I think it is something where you can imagine like a lot of exemptions being applied. But I was quite surprised to see the figure go up, because I ran a similar story on the number of flights at the start of this year, and it looked like they'd significantly dropped. And NHS England said their reason for this was the merger with like Digital and Health Education England, but we kind of worked out that hadn't increased their numbers by the same percentage as flights had gone up. And they also said a return to in-person meetings since the COVID pandemic, which I think has also been returning for quite a while. But a lot of the responses were quite interesting to that story, because people were saying, you know, in a post-COVID world, like, can a lot of this just be done online and reduce both the expense of any travel and any emissions? So I wonder whether that's going to be something to think about in future too more.
And as well, you were kind of talking about the need to get the infrastructure right. I was thinking, it's not sort of infrastructure, but kind of the reliability of trains and strikes. And I can maybe see why, if someone's trying to travel a long distance, they'll go, well, that's the only way I can get there. But also kind of around, I suppose, staff and patients and their behaviour. I can imagine there are some trusts, like London Trusts, where public transport is pretty good and you can kind of get to all corners of the city in one way or another in not too long. But then there are areas where there is no bus and you can't cycle on a dark road home at night or whatever. Like it's just, I think it's kind of getting the messaging right as well, because I can imagine it kind of backfiring or people kind of finding it a bit tone deaf. Especially if someone's like working a long shift, kind of suggesting, well, you shouldn't be driving home, kind of making people feel bad for that. I can imagine that being not handled brilliantly, perhaps in all cases.
Yeah, what I would say is there does seem to be a lot of really good work going on at trusts to help staff like travel more sustainably. So I think I saw, might have been Shrewsbury, I might have got this wrong, but about an hour ago I saw a trust had like recently done a park and ride and we're encouraging that, and there's a lot who are like getting more cycle infrastructure in and like trying to map where, for example, staff can like car share instead of all take an individual car. So I think there is a lot of good work going on in that sphere, but it is obviously harder for like more rural trusts, and I'm sure NHS England management flying around the country might not sit well with them.
The best method, no.
Yeah. And Lawrence sort of asked a similar question earlier in this conversation, but do you think there are going to be more people, perhaps at board level, who's responsible for this sort of thing? Or are there already? Perhaps I just don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, there should be. So trusts have all been told that they need a like senior responsible person for their green plan, which is effectively everyone's meant to have a net zero strategy or how to get there. So they are all meant to have a board level lead for this. And I did start doing a bit of research into this, and I think most do. So everyone should have them. Yeah.
Mm. And I think the last thing that we haven't addressed on this topic is we've kind of talked about the things that are being done and why they matter, but what I suppose what I'm trying to get at is, why is it good for the NHS to be doing these things when you don't see that immediate kind of impact, and when there are all these other competing priorities?
Yeah. I've honestly had this conversation so many times that between sustainability leads, because it's exactly what they are having to argue day in, day out.
Mm.
And a lot of what they say is, a lot of this does bring financial benefits at the same time. So when they're kind of pitching these ideas, it is, you know, invest in insulation, invest in these energy efficiency measures, and we'll cut down costs. You know, renewable energy will help against these crazy, you know, gas prices in future. Mm. So a lot of it is kind of with that financial angle, but there is a big upfront investment, I guess, that might put people off sometimes. So I'd say, firstly, like, the financial benefits of focusing on this. And then secondly, I guess it's more future looking, but will start to become more and more important, is the impact this will have on services and their finances in future if it doesn't get addressed.
Mm.
So the NHS is quite a big emitter in the UK sphere. I think it's about 4 to 5% of whole emissions. So by tackling those emissions, you are having a big impact on the carbon footprint. And we know that, like, climate change is bad for public health. If it goes unchecked, we're going to have more and more demand for health, for the health service, you know, air pollution, freak weather events, etc. So it is important to tackle that to keep demand down. But also, when climate change will create these increasingly more intense and frequent freak weather events, like flooding and heat waves, that puts additional pressure on the health service infrastructure itself. So if it can't deal with it, if it's not climate resilient, for example, buildings overheat, flooding closes off areas, it is also going to become increasingly more difficult to run the health service. So I guess it's a future-proofing insurance policy as well.
It probably does need a sort of powerful element of control from the centre, doesn't it? Mm. Because you've got local organisations and leaders are going to be focused on day-to-day operations, so you need someone at the centre mandating different targets and incentivizing those targets and then measuring performance against them. Is that even possible at the moment? Like, is there a measurement of the carbon emissions for every trust, and can they be kind of benchmarked and ranked at the moment?
No, I've also been trying to find this. So I did a story a couple of weeks ago, I think, and try to work out if all the biggest trusts know their carbon emissions, and it was quite a mixed bag. So quite a lot of them didn't know at the moment, but they were working to find them out. Mm. And I think that is quite emblematic of the entire sustainability drive at the moment. You know, people want to do this, but it is still in its early stages. I don't think NHS England they estimated the emissions for all trusts from 2019, but I don't believe they've sorted yet kind of a regular annual thing. So in short, no.
Yeah, sounds like they need to get that going.
Mm. Well, thanks very much, Zoe. I'll link to your briefing in the episode notes. But let's move on just to our last topic today, just an update really on what the plans are for winter. So Lawrence, I think it was at the very end of last week or early this week, I can't quite remember, the NHS issued its annual instructions to systems. So what did it say?
Yeah, it was the start of this week, I think. It was quite a brief letter, and to be honest, it was very similar to the one issued at the same point last year, and it was essentially addressed to hospital leaders and staff, and saying that when A&Es are really busy and there's a lot of pressure on the emergency pathway, you need to be able to depart from your normal procedures. Which essentially means admit patients through A&E and onto wards more quickly than you normally would, so sort of regardless of bed capacity and staffing ratios. And so this is a sort of similar message to what we've heard before, but it wasn't put as explicitly in last year's letter. This year that they have sort of pinpointed ambulance handover delays as the problem area where you need to ensure there's continuous flow through the hospital to avoid them. And it was so interesting. It was also signed by the NMC and the GMC, who were saying the regulatory oversight of the doctors and nurses that are making these decisions will be proportionate to the situation, and they will take the local circumstances into account. Which essentially means take into account the risk that is out in the community of the cases that the ambulances can't get to because they're queued at A&E. I think there's a relatively sensible or reasonable consensus that risk is higher, and that acute hospital wards need to take on more of the current risk. That is not obviously an ideal situation, and you might say not where the NHS should be, but that is the current reality, and so that's why this letter seemed necessary to NHS England.
Kind of reminds me of some of the letters that went out during the pandemic around from the regulators saying that staff wouldn't be kind of held to account in the same way, perhaps, if they're having to make incredibly difficult decisions. And I understand as well, there's a focus on the North Bristol model that we have talked about a few times before, but just a quick reminder for those who don't know, Lawrence, maybe about what it is.
Yeah, so North Bristol has become the sort of poster child of the continuous flow model, where you admit patients through A&E regardless of whether there is a bed available on the wards. You put extra patients on the wards essentially to improve flow through the emergency ward and reduce ambulance handover delays. One of our colleagues did an interview with Maria Kane, the CEO at North Bristol recently, and she was saying it would have worked well for them. And if you look at their sort of typical A&E performance, it has had a positive impact on that. And it was having a positive impact on ambulance handover delays. But interestingly, they do seem to have gone up in the last few months. And I was just having a look yesterday at some of how they kind of benchmarked against others. And they're again in the worst 20 trust for handover delays in the last 3 weeks. So I think something there needs a bit more investigating, which we're going to do, because it certainly hasn't solved, seems as though it certainly hasn't solved all the problems at North Bristol.
And what's the kind of reaction been to this letter? It seems to have struck a bit of a chord in the comments underneath it. I wonder kind of how, like realistically, like how closely are people going to be following this?
Yeah, I think if you read the comments, then, you know, a lot of people say these letters make no difference whatsoever. We've heard these messages before. It's not saying anything new. And to an extent, it's hard to disagree with that. And then on social media, there are a lot of outraged doctors and nurses saying it's unacceptable to plonk more patients on the wards, sort of outside of our normal procedures. But I do think there's a failure. There's an element of a failure to understand the whole situation there, and the risk that ambulance crews are having to deal with.
Well, thanks very much, Lawrence, and thanks Zoe as well. I think that's a good point to wrap up the podcast this week. And as ever, to listeners, do get in touch with any thoughts or ideas for future episodes. And thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week.